Welcome to this 2 hour special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes. I am Paul Leffler, honored to spend this time with you and reflect on the price that has been paid for the freedom we exercise so freely in our country. For many years now, I've had the privilege of visiting with World War II veterans and sharing some of their stories on radio and television. If you don't listen to KMJ on the weekends, maybe you haven't heard Hometown Heroes before. But each Saturday from 1 to 2 on News Talk 580 and from 5 to 6 p.m. on FM 105.9, I catch up with World War II veterans. In today's special, we're eventually going to broaden the scope all the way to the present and hear from a Marine whose Purple Heart was earned in 2012 in Afghanistan. But we'll start out with some World War II stories as usual. The program is called Hometown Heroes because I am absolutely convinced that no matter where you go in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary men and women who in many cases have done extraordinary things to secure our freedom. They aren't asking for the attention, but we want to honor them for their service, their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for their families and also for the rest of us. And hopefully glean a little inspiration as we hear how they endured some of the most harrowing times our United States have ever encountered. Our most recent show and the one coming up Saturday focus on different paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. But I want to start today with a guy who had a different role that fateful day. He was a glider pilot. But if you're from eastern Tulare County, you know him as the guy who has owned and operated Woodlake Hardware for decades. Morris Bennett is 89 years old now, but that memory, boy, is it sharp. Let's get a bit of the story on how the buildup for the invasion of German-occupied Europe unfolded in his life all those years ago.
Lubbock, Texas was going to be the main training base for combat gliders. We got to Lubbock, and they said, well, we got too many here to train at the same time, so everybody's going to have to go through engineering school at Wichita Falls, Texas. And that is how to put the gliders together, how to manufacture them, repair them.
And for people that aren't familiar with it, what are these gliders made out of?
They're made out of tubing and plywood and plexiglass, and covered with fabric, which was dope that they used to use in making model airplanes. So they were just the same idea, what they call dope on the fabric, and that would make reinforce them. So we had to graduate from there, and then we went back to Lubbock, and we took our advanced training there. And that was the fall of 43, and I graduated from Lubbock in December of 43.
So we're still a little more than 6 months away from D-Day here, and you would spend some of that time undergoing ground warfare training like an infantryman or artilleryman would. They had you ferrying gliders from base to base around the country, and then one day they tell you, you've got to go to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for some special training. I'm sure you had no idea how significant this was going to become. Tell me what you remember about that.
We went on down to Fort Bragg, and we were there about 10 days, took special training. We weren't told what our mission was going to be. But we knew we were going to go to Europe. And we got to Fort Wayne, Indiana. We was given all our shots. And I issued special ammunition, special guns, special revolvers, and special watches. And we sat there for about a week. In the meantime, what had happened, in Europe, the weather had changed. So they had to change the invasion date for Normandy. I know we were slated to be dropped way behind the lines, this fellas that was doing this type of work for reconnaissance or take some special deal. They never did tell us what it was, but with the equipment we had and the shots we had, we knew we was going to be on something special. But anyway, they called that mission off, sent us to Boston, and we went, instead of flying us over where we were supposed to go, in other words, we went across on a troop ship, which took 3 or 4 days, and I joined the 439th Group in the 94th Squadron of troop carrier, which had been in England about 6 or 7 weeks, something like that. We knew that invasion was coming very shortly, so we had to carry full packs and run for every day. And so we got there, and they didn't have enough American gliders, so I had to fly a English glider, a horse glider, and the Normandy. And I went on June 6th, so there was just a breaking day, probably. We was on double daylight saving. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. We took off from our base, and I had just had paratroopers is what we had instead of glider fighters, which normally glider infantry is what we normally would carry. But they had put paratroopers in these gliders, and they didn't like They'd rather jump than ride a glider.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there because we need to take a break. But this is really striking. On one of the most monumental days in human history, we know now, you weren't exactly set up to succeed there. A powerless plane you'd never flown before with paratroopers who were not happy to be on a glider. And, oh, by the way, there were Germans down there, and you'd be landing behind enemy lines. Holy cow. We'll find out how that turned out when this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today is a 1940 graduate of Woodlake High School in Tulare County, home of the Tigers, of course. He started working at Woodlake Hardware the day after he graduated, and he's owned the place now for decades. But there's one day of Morris Bennett's life that is pretty unforgettable. June 6th, 1944. Let's pick up where we left off now. Instead of the American CG-4 glider you'd trained on, you were flying a British Horsa glider. Take us back there.
The Horsa, a British glider, will hold 30 people, plus a pilot and a co-pilot. And we had gas masks. We didn't know what we would have. So we were one of the few gliders that landed intact in Normandy. And we landed, like I say, it was just breaking day. The pro ships had already been in and flown paratroopers in and dropped them about 4 hours before we went. And they came back to England, refueled, tied up on the gliders, and when they would take us off, we were Cliff Mueller, which passed away a few years ago. He was and I flew together, and we were in the air. Cliff was on in the first pilot seat, and I was on the other one, and we couldn't get the nose wheel up. The tow ship was already in the air. Normally, the tow ship is still on the ground, and we were in the air, but you could see the exhaust because this was dark. You could see the blue coming out of the exhaust, and we were still on the ground. We were about ready to cut off and land in the ocean, and we went ahead and made the deal. We were back about, I think we was 45 or 40, usually 50 gliders in a stick, what we call a group. Each group would have a deal, and it takes about 45 minutes to make the group together to come back in a formation. And they're four abreast, just staggered four across.
Well, and it seems to me, and again, a lot of people might have no knowledge of gliders at all, so they probably want to know, what were the tow ships? How did you guys get airborne? What
normally on a Horsa glider, they were towed by the British four-engine Fairfax bombers. But our C-47s or DC-3s, which are some people call them one thing, some people call them something else, they were able to tow a Horsa glider or two CG-4 gliders on twin tow, which we flew later on, but not on Normandy, which was just a single tow on, even on the CG-4s.
Where are the ropes tied onto your glider?
Not on ropes, and I don't remember what they are. In other words, I got it in 330 feet or 350 foot, about 5/8, 7/8 nylon rope.
Kind of like the stuff you sell here at Woodlake Hardware, huh? You can get it by the foot.
We don't sell as big as what we had then. Like on takeoff, when we couldn't here about 10 years ago, Cliff came by and visited me one day, and he says, "I guess you know you saved my life." And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "Don't you recall telling those paratroopers to some of them get back on the plane a little bit so we get the nose wheel off?" And I said, "No, I don't remember." And he says, "Well, I sure as hell did."
You had to rebalance the plane, huh?
Yeah, balance it up to get, that's how come we was able to go ahead and get off. Otherwise,
you never would have gotten off the ground.
In other words, we would end in the ocean. And with these 30 guys behind us, that's much aid in this thing. And we weren't that really good Horsa pilots because we hadn't flown in a Horsa that much. In CG-4, in other words, I could have done a lot more with it, but in other words, not with that thing.
You spent over a year training to fly one kind of glider. Then on the biggest day of your life, you end up in a glider you've never flown before, and you're going to end up in the English Channel, and you're all going to sink in the ocean if you didn't make that adjustment, huh? Where do you think that came from? What clicked in your mind to ask them to do that?
I don't know. It just wasn't coming off. I said, we got to get some weight in the back end up to get the nose up. I don't know. It's just one of them things that you do.
What was your mission, and how did it unfold?
Normandy, in other words, we landed, like I say, about daylight. We got to the CP. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, which was a command post where the 101st Troopers, paratroopers, And with St. Mary's Galice is where the town was that we landed, and that's where the CP was in an apple orchard. I told the glider pilots, in other words, you head back for the beach. Your mission is done for this deal. Go back to the beach and you fly another mission. So we started back, walking back. Some people rode a bicycle or most of it walking. There was about 15 of us got a Jeep that had been wrecked earlier. We got on it and then got back to the beachhead. And the tanks were coming in. By this time, it was probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. One of the tank commanders says, get that pile of junk out of the road. And we just drove off the side of the road and off the sand dune and walked on the rest of the way in. And then they said, well, these guys have all lost their guns and everything coming in. So stack your guns and ammunition over there. And these other fellas have lost theirs on the landing. They've got something to work with. And they said, get on this landing craft and go out to this British cruiser that has shot its guns out on the earlier landing. They were earlier that morning. They're going back to Britain. So by 9 o'clock, I was on this cruiser, and the next morning I was back in England. And I got a 3-day pass because, in other words, everything worked all right, and I didn't have to go back on another mission on that one.
But I'm sure there's a lot more to that day than what you just shared with us. You take off from England, and you are going over the English Channel, being towed by these bigger planes. What did you see? Did you see a bunch of other gliders? Did you see bombers everywhere? Did you see ships down below? Paint a picture for us.
Thousands of all types of battleships. The Navy was, there was the landing. In other words, we could see the firing. In other words, ahead of us where we were headed. And as the tow ships went in earlier, as I was said, earlier, in other words, they dropped the paratroopers, and then so when the tow pilots got close to where the anti-aircraft fire was coming up to us, in other words, they already had turned, and they were normally, they'd be going straight ahead on us, but they'd already turned, and they was off to our left. It was almost 0.25 degrees from where they should have been, and so we kept going as far as we could till we cut loose, and we'd seen a field that we could land in that didn't have the telephone poles, what they called the Rommel's asparagus, and the hedgerows is what got most of us. We had no idea that they briefed us on the hedgerows, but they didn't tell us that the hedgerows were full of rocks, which was maybe 10, 15, 20 foot wide and 10 or 15 foot high. And that's what most of the gliders ran into. In other words, that landed, the crash stop was hitting the trees and the hedgerows.
Well, I've got some more questions about that, and we'll go there when this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues after this on KMJ. Welcome back to this Memorial Day special edition of Hometown Heroes. Before we're done with this two-hour program, you're going to hear from someone in our newest generation of veterans. She earned a Purple Heart in Afghanistan. But now let's continue with the normal focus of this program when it airs each Saturday at 1. That would be, of course, our greatest generation. You've been listening to Morris Bennett, who flew a glider and landed behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944. Let's try to get a more detailed understanding now of what that was like. So what did you see, and how did you know where to go and where to land? And were you scared at all? Because I'd be scared out of my mind.
Well, in other words, we were briefed about these fields being flooded with water. Of course, you knew it wouldn't be very deep. I could see a cut in the trees where there was an open deal and a little field beyond that. And if you were good at what you were doing, you was able to get into it. And we figured we'd get into it, and we did. All we did was knock the nose wheel off when we hit one little ditch across, because you couldn't tell from the air by a little ditching. But we knocked the nose wheel off, and otherwise it was landed right up where we were supposed to be. And everybody got off. There was a few of them sick, but...
Okay, so now you're coming in. You fly in over the beaches where all this fierce fighting is happening, and you're supposed to land behind enemy lines. You don't really have a way out of there other than your 2 feet. How do you know where you're going, and how do you think you're actually going to make it out of this alive? You know there's a war going on.
It depended on the guys that you had with us, in other words, the troopers, because they were more advanced than we just followed the boards. We were just a trooper then. After we got on the ground, we were just whatever the, maybe he was a first sergeant or somebody else. He says, in other words, like the band of brothers, you come on with me and you go, we'll get back to where we're supposed to go. We knew we was going to be the same as least we knew about where we were, but not exactly.
Did you have any idea? I mean, obviously your own life is in jeopardy here, but did you have any idea of what those paratroopers would be up against with the kind of fighting they were going to face?
No, I don't think any of us really knew what was going to be the up against. It was one of those things that everything worked out good for me.
Was that landing? Were you anxious? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't. Just like no different than flying in Indianapolis when I would come in and land in where I was supposed to be, or the first time when I ran out of gas. I had another one when I was in training. In other words, on ferry. In other words, the tow ship, the glider came loose from the tow ship. They didn't make a good connection with the tow ship. And I was over out of St. Louis in the Ozarks. Everybody and all the farmers and little towns in the woods in the Ozarks, they come looking. Here was an 85-foot airplane in our backyard. And it had been snowing, so there was probably about 3 or 4 foot of snow on the ground. But I flew a pattern in. I seen a little hump in the snow, and I figured that was a fence, and sure enough it was. So I just got over it and sat down, and I dug in the snow, and I flew up to this guy's barn, landed right close to his barn. They took us in the house and fed us biscuits and bacon, and boy, really had a real good meal. And pretty soon the constable came, which was the law enforcement they had on an old Model A car, and he took us to the little bus stop. And I had a telephone there, and I called the base, and they said, "Oh, we already know that your tow ship circled you and said you were down okay." So, but the tow rope had come loose from the glider. We never did anything, so we just left it there. And the Army sent in a ground crew and picked it up.
Well, in the snow by St. Louis, they're waiting for you with bacon and biscuits. But on June 6th, when you put that thing down, was there concern that enemy forces might be nearby?
Oh, yes. We knew they were ground people because we'd seen them. The dead fellas already there where the paratroopers had already been fighting with them on our way to the CP. And we knew that they were being shot at every once in a while then. So we took the hedgerows, the roads along the hedgerows, and we'd be in the ditches. And we stayed in the ditches like that until when we were strung out maybe 10 to 15 feet apart, protecting each other, till we got to the CP. And then on the way back, when it was in that Jeep, in other words, we got come under sniper fire for a while, but we took care of the 17 of us took care of him, and then we went on our way back to the beachhead.
And did you have any special instructions for what you were to do with the glider after you landed it?
Just leave it.
I know, I'm sure you've told these stories before, but you describe it so matter-of-factly, and it sure seems intimidating to me to land a glider behind enemy lines and have to work your way back, not knowing where the enemy is, to be shot at by snipers, all of this stuff that you've never experienced before, and you're just a young kid. What do you think it was that helped you get through that and helped you believe you could?
I don't know. It's just the way that, I suppose, the way that I was raised, in other words, and worked on. My dad was killed when I was 1930, so I was 8 years old in an automobile accident, a foggy morning at Hanford. And so I lived with my grandfather and my uncles, and they did taught me all the things that I needed to know to survive.
They must have taught you pretty well. So you told us how you got back, but even when you get back to that beach and you're supposed to go out to this British ship, what did that beach look like? I mean, was there devastation everywhere?
Well, we were strafed a couple of times. We had to dig into the sand because the Germans they came and strafed the beach with fighter planes a couple of times, but didn't last very long until our fighters took over, and that was it. They were still firing at that first on the 6th of June at night. That night they were still fighting on the beachhead.
And you got to get off that beach. A landing craft took you to that British ship, but I imagine there are a lot of images from that 24-hour period you simply cannot erase from your memory. What'd you see from the deck of that ship?
I seen this big ship ahead of mine or something, and it was big. It was maybe 200 or 300, 400 foot long. I mean, a big ship. I don't know whether it was a cruiser or what. But it just went up in the air, and then down I went. And you knew all these guys were on it. Never seen anybody get off of it. So, I mean, that was probably the worst thing that I'd seen as far as of all the other things that happened. There were that, and they were just before dark.
So that's what Morris Bennett remembers about June 6th, 1944. Listen to Hometown Heroes this coming Saturday at 1, and you'll hear two paratroopers remember what they faced in jumping behind enemy lines that day. As for Morris, he was back in England when fellow glider pilots participated in the invasion of southern France. And by September of 1944, the Allies were preparing a massive airborne and ground assault that would include over 2,000 gliders in addition to other air forces. It was called Operation Market Garden, and it was aimed at pushing German forces back through the Netherlands and across the Rhine River in the hopes of ending the war in Europe by Christmas. That's not exactly how it unfolded, and it would be another dangerous mission that Morris Bennett was fortunate to survive.
They moved the group to Châteaudun in France, and I was our main base until the European war was over. The next mission then after that, when the combat mission we had, was Arnhem, Nijmegen, we had Grossbeck, and we had the 82nd Airborne is what we took in, and we didn't have enough pilots, so we didn't even have a co-pilot. And part of the equipment I had there was a trailer with all the signal equipment, all the electronics for the communications for the whole group. So I had the trailer with that and the two people that worked with it. Some of them were shot down on the way in, but we knew it was going to be a rough mission. It was about 3 hours on tow, and we left somewhere around 7 in the morning. It was in September. We had May West, but I put an extra flak suit under my seat and went over my legs and went over my deal. And right after we hit the coast of the roads, then we were shot at by ground fire, barges on the bottom, and then we were shot at also by fighters. But the Spitfires came in and the P-51s came in, off defense boys, and they took those out and they took out the other deal. But I could see the tracers coming down there. You see them going through the side of the tow ship and come out on down the tow line. And then by that time they were going through ours. And that was probably the scariest mission that I had as far as wonder if I was even going to get on the ground. But after we got over the barges and got a little further inland, we was able to land. But I was picking up ground fire after I hit the CP. And we landed about 10:30 in the morning, and the paratroopers were dropping at the same time we dropped. Normally, the paratroopers come in ahead of us and clear the ground before we get in. But we were on the ground at the same time that they were. First Lieutenant ran over to me, and he says, I kind of cracked up a little bit. I mean, I had to get on the ground because I was being shot at pretty heavy.
And that glider, with what it's made out of, doesn't take fire very well.
And so I landed a little bit faster than I normally would land, and it was sandy, and I nosed over. So I just knocked the nose end of it off a little bit, but the load and everything else was on the ground in good shape. I landed right by an ammunition dump. There were all kinds of ammunition and guns and everything. There were stacks of them that the Germans had got together. And I says, I think I'm okay. In other words, of course, I was kind of dusty and dirty. Of course, you got probably 30 pounds of equipment, your helmet and all your other gear and the ammunition, and your legs are full of groceries for 3 or 4 days or whatever the case would be. You have everything on you that you don't have no chance of picking nothing up. You're all ready to go. So when you landed, you got out of there. We went over to this castle, and the German officers had just left it, having breakfast. Everything was still ham and eggs and everything just on the table when we landed. And so we stayed there that afternoon, and then that night they marched us downtown, and we took the bridge that crossed the Rhine, the 82nd Airborne. Mortar fire was hitting us pretty heavy. So they come over and said, in other words, well, you glider pilots, you are guards. You're going to be MPs. So I was an MP for 3 weeks with about 10 glider pilots, and we had over 3,000 prisoners.
And you found a way to get that done, too. Why am I not surprised? It's time for another brief break. Still to come, another Tulare County veteran who is not around to tell his story because he didn't get to come home from World War II. He earned the Congressional Medal of Honor, sacrificing his life for his fellow soldiers. I'll share a little of that story. But first, the rest of Morris Bennett's tale when this Memorial Day special continues on KMJ. Welcome back to our Hometown Heroes Memorial Day special. You've been listening to an example of what this show is normally about each Saturday from 1 to 2 on AM 580 or 5 to 6 on FM 105.9. It's about World War II veterans sharing their stories. We're going to branch out from that a little later today. But let's finish up now with Morris Bennett. He flew gliders with the 94th Squadron of the 439th Troop Carrier Group. That outfit received the Presidential Unit Citation for its work at Normandy. Time for him to tell us about a little colder locale he thought he was destined for.
Well, the next one was resupply on Bastogne. But what happened on that, I was ready to go. I was to take, it was on December 25th, and I was supposed to take off. The weather turned bad, and I really loaded, and all I had was ammunition to resupply. And went out the next morning. I didn't have to fly it because they brought in another somebody else because they said I'd already had flown enough missions.
So you were going to fly a glider into Bastogne in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge.
Right. And I was set to go on that, but in other words, I didn't fly it. So somebody else flew my glider, but it was wrecked, and the guy that flew it was killed. It was on the pilots that took it in the next day.
Well, I was about to imagine that fate for you if you would have flown it, and there's no mystery to it when you tell me that. How do you account for all of those situations where it should have been you and it wasn't?
I think the old boy up above is watching over me, and he had something more for me to do. That's the only thing that I've had, because I had too many of them that just wasn't done till they could have been 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour later. So then the next mission we had was crossing the Rhine at Wesel, which was only 50 miles on the river from where we dropped in September, or the ridge on the Grossbeck drop. But I had, I think, just troopers, and I flew a CG-4, and we flew a twin two gliders on the same tow ship. We came in across the Rhine River Valley, and it broke out of the smoke about 200 feet, and all I had was an apple orchard ahead of us. Just landed down between the apple orchard and took the wings off, the outside wings. Came in pretty high and slipped and straightened out just before got where I was supposed to land. And of course, it took some real good flying there to do it. Flying by your seat of pants again. Landed, and we were right up against an 88. By this time, that the German army couldn't hit the airplanes at a low altitude. They had to be up pretty high before they could hit them. They didn't know how to set their guns to shoot at 500 feet. But they got where they were, there the tail end, and we landed within maybe 50 feet of a German 88 gun emplacement. And my crew, my ground people, was able to take them over right then.
So the troopers you were carrying took out that 88. Otherwise, you would have been blown to smithereens.
Well, that's right. In other words, there was it. And then the next morning, we stayed that night all night in foxholes, and we took parachutes that had been dropped and wrapped them around for to keep warm. And next morning we went back, and that was the end of my fighting.
But you would add C-47 navigator duties, and in that role fly resupply missions and also carry some pretty memorable passengers.
Well, C-47, I think we'd haul 15 or 20 people normally. In other words, we'd have 40 or 50 of these prisoners that we took all of those concentration camps. And we have a nurse on board, and we had to be deloused, in other words, because everybody had lice.
To see the shape that those prisoners were in, what was that like emotionally, just to see people?
That was probably the worst thing that of everything that I can remember, in other words. I mean, that's why I support the service and the people there, because, in other words, unless you see it, people can't believe how the shape that those prisoners was in.
What did they look like?
If a person that would weigh 180 to 200 pounds, weigh 85 or 90 pounds, it'd be like going to a rest home where all the people had cancer, and you could smell it when you walk in. In other words, and you could smell them when you even before you got there.
These weren't American prisoners of war. These were people that had been in the concentration camps?
They were both. We saw a lot of the prisoners of war, our prisoners of war back, and the people that were in concentration camps, both ways. And most of our soldiers weren't, or airmen that was there, they weren't dilapidated or, you know, like the concentration camp people were. The concentration camp people were in really bad shape.
And at that time, had you been aware at all of what was happening in those concentration camps, or was this just a complete shock to your system that people could be in this kind of condition?
No, I had no idea. I don't think anybody would. I don't think anybody would realize it even now, unless you were there, shape that they'd be in.
And when you see something like that, I mean, obviously everything that you've been through is pretty incredible. When you see something like that, does that make it seem more important to you to talk about it, to make sure people know about what happened in World War II?
Well, for 40 years, 35 or 40 years, I didn't even mention my overseas time, because I guess most of us kept herself pretty well in herself, even when we got together.
You're one of the last ones left. There weren't very many glider pilots to begin with.
There were about roughly 5,000 glider pilots trained to start with.
How many do you think are still around?
Probably 1,500, maybe, in thereabouts. There's only two in the valley that I know of.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Being able to do the job that I did, I guess, without getting hurt.
What was it like to come home when the war was over and you were done?
They flew us back in B-24s. I had a buddy, and a lot of us was able to even, there was only two or three of us in a B-24, but in other words, they flew back, and some of them went and had a buddy, Bob Baker. He was in another one, and they said off to our wing. In other words, they developed trouble, and they went in after going through all the deals that we both of us have went through together, in other words, and flown together. According to the reunions and everything, that he was killed in on the Vasa mission when we were down. But I know when he went down on the way back.
Another it could have just as easily been you moment. You got back to the States, thought for sure you'd be flying gliders in an impending invasion of Japan. But while you had a short leave, you had to make sure to see your wife, who'd been waiting patiently and praying for you back home in California.
I picked up my wife and we went to...
Don't gloss over that. You hadn't seen your wife in how long?
3.5 years.
And I'm sure there are days you didn't think you were going to see her again, right?
No, I always figured I was going to make it. She used to tell me, in other words, a few years past, before she passed away 10 years ago, she said, "You think you're going to live forever." In other words, I know I'm not, but that's what... She always said that you think you're going to go forever, but we went to Cambria Pines when she had an uncle over that had retired from the service several years before. So we went over the coast and spent a couple of days there, and during that time, they dropped the bomb on Japan, and the war was over, and I would report back to San Diego. I got a separation from active duty, but never no discharge. I'm still separated from active duty.
So when you think about the fact that you're... children would have never been born, your grandchildren and great-grandchildren would have never been born if you hadn't survived all those situations where it could have been you. What does that make you thankful for now?
I don't know. You don't really think too much about it, really, but I think we got a pretty good country up to the right to present time. We're in a bad shape, but maybe we'll get it straightened around.
And for people that weren't alive then, what do you want them to know about the guys that you served with? What all those brave men and women did 70 years ago, what do you think we need to remember about that time in our history?
Well, I think we should remember that some people don't believe in God, but in other words, I do. I believe that he had his hand in watching over what I was supposed to be doing. And so I think, in other words, I think we still need God in our country and behind our deal. I don't think this idea of taking over and going to a socialist type of country and letting the government run everything. I think the people should run the country as what we did back when I was a kid.
Well, I just want to say on behalf of our listeners, thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us some of those stories. If we park a CG-4 at the airfield down the road, you going to climb in behind the wheel?
Yeah, I could.
I do not doubt it for one second. What a special guy with a special story. When we come back, something that strikes at the core of what Memorial Day is all about. A story you probably haven't heard before about a hero from right here in the San Joaquin Valley who was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for the way he sacrificed his own life for others in World War II. You'll have to settle for hearing it in my voice because he's not around to tell us. But the details alone are quite amazing. That's next with more of Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Welcome back to this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll be breaking for the news coming up at the top of the hour. In the second hour of this special, something for those of you who don't have your greatest generation parents or grandparents around anymore. You're probably thinking about them on this Memorial Day. And just because they're not here doesn't mean you won't be able to learn something about their service. You never know what you might find or what might find you, as we'll hear. You'll also meet a Marine back from Afghanistan with a Purple Heart and get a feel for what it's like to be a returning veteran today. Right now, a story that I'm guessing you haven't heard before. I hadn't heard it until a Korean War veteran in Tulare named George Manis clued me in. Thanks, George. It's the story of one of the Valley's Congressional Medal of Honor winners. Memorial Day was established to remember those who died while fighting for our country. And it's hard to top the courage displayed by Roy Woodrow Harmon. They knew him as Bill Harmon around Pixley in Tulare County, where he worked on a farm before World War II. I'm going to read to you an article Carla McFetridge wrote for the Pixley Enterprise a quarter century ago. It is consistent with the Congressional Medal of Honor citation for Mr. Harmon. A bright, sunny July 12, 1944 marked the day of his heroism and began what is known as the famous Battle of the Haystacks. For the first 5 minutes, the peaceful Italian countryside stayed peaceful. Harmon was beginning to think he wouldn't see any action this day either when suddenly the ground underneath him and all around him erupted. Peering around the side of the mound, he saw three haystacks near the crest of the hill. Could the enemy gunners be hiding in the haystacks, he wondered. He watched the stacks closely for a minute, but when no machine gun fire came from them, he thought he was wrong. Turning to look further to the left, he saw a flash out of the corner of his eye. The German gunners were in the haystacks. Grabbing his submachine gun, Harmon carefully aimed a tracer at the haystacks, hoping to catch it on fire, but the range was too great. It fell short on each of the five attempts. Slowly, the trapped platoon that had been ahead of them was being massacred. He couldn't just lie there and watch others die. The sergeant made up his mind. He checked the supply of phosphorus grenades in his belt and shouted, "Cover me," to the men behind him. And grabbing one of the grenades in his right hand, he started crawling toward the nearest haystack. The ground was hard and stony, scraping the sergeant's elbows raw as he crawled. Harmon ignored his badly scratched and bleeding stomach as he eased yard by yard toward the haystack, while the 302nd GIs hidden behind him kept up a steady barrage of fire at the enemy positions. After figuring how long it would take to hurl the phosphorus grenade, he pulled his legs up under his body, placed his submachine gun on the ground beside him, and held the grenade ready. Taking one last look at the haystack, he straightened up, yanked the pin, and drew his arm back ready to throw. At that moment, the closest German turned and looked straight at him, pivoted his gun, and yelled a warning to his comrades. Harmon brought his arm down and let the grenade go. It was a Bobby Feller pitch, hard and accurate. The grenade landed directly on top of the haystack and exploded. The German gunner who had spotted him began firing, the bullets passing only inches over his head. When the hay started burning, two of the gunners started to run back toward their own lines. Harmon took aim and shot both of them. He took advantage of the flames that shot nearly 100 feet into the air and blocked the vision of the German gunners in the second haystack to race to a new position. Harmon made his first mistake, which almost proved fatal, when he began moving toward the second haystack. After 10 yards, Harmon ran out of cover, and an enemy gunner spotted him, waiting to get a sure shot. Crack! Harmon jerked from the force of the bullet a fraction of a second before it was heard. The slug hit him in the right side, whirling him around in a half circle and down to one knee. For a moment, he was stunned and didn't move as bullets ripped the ground around him, but did not hit him. As if in a trance, he limped toward the haystack, ignoring the bullets and calls to come back, blasting a path with his submachine gun. He came to within 25 yards of the stack, jerked another grenade from his belt, and threw it before the gunners could cut him down, setting the stack on fire and shooting the fleeing Germans. The third haystack was 150 yards of open ground away. Harmon staggered forward, moving slowly, leaving behind him a trail of blood. Harmon was within 30 yards of the stack when he was hit a second time. He went down hard, crumbling sideways. It was several seconds before Harmon began struggling back to his feet, finally crawling forward, inching his way as though drawn to a magnet. The Germans turned their guns on him, ignoring all others. The wounded sergeant struggled to his knees, grenade clutched in his right hand, poised with his arm drawn back to throw. His ripped shirt was blood-soaked, his helmet cocked crazily to one side as the muzzles of the enemy guns pointed straight at him. In seconds, it was over. The grenade arched through the air in a perfect toss, but before it reached the haystacks, the German machine guns chattered. The grenade hit the top of the stack at the same instant Harmon hit the ground. The hay flamed. Harmon died. 5 days later, the 91st Division reached the Arno River, the first American division to gain control of the river's south bank. The U.S. Army recognized the determination and bravery of Sergeant Roy W. Harmon on October 22, 1945, when it awarded him the nation's highest award for bravery, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Is that a hero or what? From right here in our San Joaquin Valley. We'll be back with another hour of this Memorial Day special. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ. Welcome to hour number two of our Hometown Heroes Memorial Day special.
We're going to take this program in a little different direction now. Most of the time when you're listening to this program, you hear me reflect on the importance of getting our veteran stories preserved before they're gone and they can't tell them to us anymore. It's also true that sometimes, even after a veteran has passed on, we can learn more about that person's service to our country. And we're going to illustrate that point as I welcome in Marshall McCall. He has served in our armed forces, and his father was a decorated fighter pilot during World War II. And I'm curious, Marshall, before we talk about the latest twist that I think people really will be interested in, growing up as the son of a World War II fighter pilot, how much did you hear about what your dad did in the war? How much did he actually tell you?
He didn't really talk to me very much about what he had done until I was an adult. But when I was little, I remember sneaking downstairs and hiding around the corner so I could hear him talking to his buddies. Mm-hmm. And they had lots and lots of stories, and some of them were even true, I'm sure.
You know, I've tried that before, too, sneaking around so I can hear the guys talking to their buddies, because they do open up a lot more. Was that something that you started to understand how remarkable his experiences were to be so young? Here's a guy in his young 20s. He's flying a P-51, which at that point was the most able aircraft America could produce, and he's doing it in a time of war, shooting down enemy airplanes, being shot at himself. Could you understand what that must have been like for him? Did you have any idea?
You know, I really didn't, because I just took it for granted because it was something my dad had done. It wasn't until I was probably in my 40s or maybe even my 50s that I realized that he had really done some remarkable things as I started to reflect on the history of it. And as I got to know more people that knew about airplanes, World War II airplanes, that he was, you know, had to have been a really superior pilot to survive that time there.
Mm-hmm. Is that what made you want to be in the Air Force yourself?
It was. I always thought it would be great to be in the Air Force, and I always wanted to be a pilot. But unfortunately, I found out when I was in ROTC at Fresno State that my eyes weren't good enough to fly, even to be a navigator. So I ended up being a ground pounder in the Air Force during Vietnam.
We thank you for serving. And I'm very appreciative of you sharing this story that you're going to tell us about your dad. Now, before he passed away, did you get him to tell you any of those stories? Did you have a few things that you just thought were really neat that he actually experienced in the cockpit?
We did talk about it, but, you know, he didn't really view it as anything out of the ordinary. To him, it was just a day's work, and so he wasn't that interested really in talking about it to share the stories. We finally got him to make some cassette tapes when he was in his early 80s talking about his history during the war, and I do have those.
Good for you.
But now I don't have a cassette player anymore.
Yeah, they're a little obsolete. I think we have one around here if you need some help with that. So you did get him to share a few of those stories. But there
yes, I did.
And it is pretty impressive what he did because, you know, you look back on history now, and he had 4 confirmed kills as a P-51 pilot, 2 unconfirmed, so he was an ace, just not confirmed. Does that give you a degree of pride?
Oh, yeah. I remember asking him about that when I was in high school or college, if he was an ace or not, and he said, well, not really. He said, I had enough kills, but he said they weren't all confirmed. He had one mission where he had 2 victories. But his wing camera, which were coordinated with the guns, machine guns in the wing camera jammed on that mission. It used old-fashioned film, you know, they didn't have digital stuff then. And it jammed, and he didn't have any proof.
Well, if something's going to jam, it's better it's the camera than the machine gun.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he might not have had any stories to tell. And if you go online to kmjnow.com, you can see a picture of Marshall's father, Evan McCall, and the airplane that he kept naming. He had Fool's Paradise, and he kept losing those airplanes till he ended up with Fool's Paradise 4?
That's correct. He had a P-39 when he was still back in the States, stationed up in Hamilton Field in San Rafael, Marin County. And then he had Fool's Paradise the 2nd, which was another P-39. After the first one crashed, he crashed it, was too low to bail out, walked away from the crash out in El Paso, Texas area.
Mm-hmm.
Fool's Paradise the 3rd was a P-51B, which was a little bit different airplane than the P-51D, which was Fool's Paradise the 4th.
And Fool's Paradise the 4th was the P-51 that he flew quite frequently toward the tail end of his service in World War II. But even on his dying day, he never knew what became of that aircraft. Why didn't he know what happened to Fool's Paradise the 4? Explain to us the circumstances, how he left that airplane and wasn't clear on what happened.
Actually, as near as I can tell, there were around 60,000 P-51s that were built during World War II, and some of them stayed in service back through the Korean War with the United States Air Force, and some of them were sold to South American countries and other smaller countries that needed air defense into the 50s, and I don't think there's any still in service, but there are some still flying. But
thank the Lord, yeah, and they sound beautiful, don't they?
Yeah, they really do.
Let me hold you up there. Break time. When we come back, we'll find out how Marshall's father's World War II adventures came back to the forefront even after he died. More of this special edition of Hometown Heroes right after this on KMJ. Welcome back to this Memorial Day special edition of Hometown Heroes. We're going to hear about some very special mementos that Marshall McCall has in his possession. You can see them on the Hometown Heroes blog at kmjnow.com. Marshall served in the Air Force during the Vietnam era. His father, the late Evan McCall, was an accomplished fighter pilot. Time to pick up that story.
He was a squadron commander, a major, when he was 24 years old. When it was time for him to come back to the States, he was reassigned to Patton's 3rd Armored Division as a forward air controller. In those days, a forward air controller didn't fly in an airplane. They rode on the back of a big Jeep, big radio mounted in the back of a Jeep. And they would vector in close air support to the troops on the ground. So he had a unique perspective of seeing the war from the air and also from the ground with Patton's 3rd Armored Division. So he did talk about that once in a while. That was a little bit unusual for him because he was a flyer. You know, he was an Air Force guy. It was called Army Air Corps then.
Yeah.
So he didn't know, and I'd ask him, whatever happened to the plane? He said, oh, it's probably at the bottom of the English Channel. He didn't know. About a year ago, I guess, or less maybe, my niece, who lives in Ireland now, had found a picture of my dad and some of his squadron friends sitting on the wing of his airplane, and she'd seen it on Facebook. She gave me a heads up, so I corresponded with the person on Facebook, and they said they didn't know much about the plane, but they knew somebody that might, and they referred me to somebody else, and that person didn't know much about the plane, but they referred me to somebody else again, and I finally got a hold of this guy in France named Gilles Colvert, and we corresponded a little bit. He wanted to know more about my dad's history. He was real interested in the airplane, so I wrote a little history and sent it to him and with some photos.
Now, and not to interrupt, but when did your father die?
My dad died in 2006, in November of 2006, and he was 88 years old at that time.
So in those 5 years from when he died to this started up, had you ever wondered if you might find that airplane someday?
Never thought about it because he didn't seem very worried about it. He just said, well, it's probably, you know, probably at the bottom of the English Channel.
It was nowhere near your thought life. It wasn't even a consideration.
No, it really wasn't. I hadn't given it any thought at all. I had some pictures that I had in my den, pictures of my dad and pictures of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful airplane.
So because of your niece in Ireland and the magic of Facebook, you are kind of revived to this story or turned back on to this idea, and you connect with this guy in France. Were you expecting much? Did you think something might come of it?
Not really. I didn't know what to expect, but I thought it was interesting just to follow up and to tell him, yeah, well, that was my dad's plane. And so I, you know, want to say, hey, you know, I know a little bit about that airplane. That was my dad's plane. He named it and he flew it. I think all his combat missions, except for the first few, were in the Fool's Paradise the Fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Then this gentleman, Gilles Colvert in France, actually had published an article in a French magazine, and he sent me a copy of that and an English translation. He speaks, or at least writes, perfect English. So he sent me that, and subsequently, in August of 2011, which is less than a year ago, he actually found the wreckage of that airplane. And according to him, the research he did was that there was a German convoy going through a small French village. The Allies had called in air support to try to wipe out this convoy. By that stage of the war, the Germans were pretty much finished, but I guess they were still fighting. My dad's former squadron at that time was called in to strafe and bomb this German convoy. And as they did so, Fool's Paradise the Fourth was hit with German flak. And one weakness of the P-51 was that it had a liquid-cooled engine, and the radiator was down underneath the wing.
And the P-47 guys will remind you that every time because they had air-cooled. Yeah,
they will. They'll remind you that every time. But then, of course, the P-51 pilots will come back and respond that driving a P-47 was like driving a truck.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like that. But it would take a lot more punishment than a P-51.
And to clarify again for people that are just catching on, your father had been flying that plane for a lot of missions in that plane, but now was reassigned, was actually performing his duty on the ground. Another pilot is in this plane,
yes.
Fool's Paradise the Fourth. another, when it is hit by German flag.
That's correct. Another pilot. As a matter of fact, Gilles Colvert told me the name of the pilot, his name was Lewis Morrison, was flying the plane, was hit by flak. Major Morrison pulled up as high as he could. They didn't have ejection seats in those days. You had to jettison the canopy and jump out and hope that you didn't hit the tail. He parachuted safely and was rescued by some French farmers and was taken back to Allied lines. But the airplane crashed at the edge of a wooded area, and that's where Gilles Colvert found the airplane and subsequently sent me a beautiful frame picture of the plane as it was during the war. And on the glass, on the front of the picture frame, he's actually epoxied some pieces that came from that airplane. It's quite a thrill to see those. There's a bullet from a 50 caliber bullet. There's a piece of the landing gear retracting handle and a piece of gnarled, looks like aluminum tubing of some sort that came from that wreckage.
And we'll put a picture of that up at kmjnow.com if you want to see these souvenirs that came more than 60 years after that plane crashed in France. What did that mean to you when you opened that package and you saw these pieces of your father's airplane 5 years after your father has died? What did that mean to you?
It meant a lot. You kind of get the shakes. You see something like that. And the main thing I thought was, gee whiz, I just wish Dad was here so I could call him and tell him about this and show him this souvenir that I got. Mm-hmm. He would have been really interested. But I have a feeling he knows about it anyway.
Amen. And I thought it was important to share your story with our audience because there are a lot of people that are in your shoes now where their parents are gone and they aren't around to fill in the details of some of the stories or to give them some of the souvenirs. And it's just a reminder that you never know what you might find, even if you're not looking for it, as is your case.
But that's not all Marshall has to remember his father by. He'll tell us about the itty-bitty souvenir that can lead to some pretty heavy and sobering thoughts. More of our Hometown Heroes Memorial Day special right after this on KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to our Hometown Heroes Memorial Day special. Marshall McCall has shared with us the story of how he came to possess pieces of his World War II fighter pilot father's long-lost airplane.
I want to ask you, though, too, about another souvenir you have, because this one, I guess, is a reminder of how fragile everything is. Often on the show, I talk to veterans about what if. What if they were one of the more than 400,000 Americans who died in World War II, those that we honor on this Memorial Day? In your case, if your dad didn't come home from the war, I do the math on your age, you would have never been born.
That's correct.
And you've got a souvenir that I think kind of reminds you of how close that came to happening that way. It's not even as big as a nickel, I would say, but it's a piece of shrapnel that has a pretty good story behind it. What is that story?
Well, sometime after D-Day, my dad's squadron did a lot of close air support work at that time. Most P-51s were long-range escort. But right after D-Day, my dad's squadron was flying in close air support on D-Day and thereafter for a few months. I don't know the exact history of how many missions and so forth. But they were strafing a railroad yard along the Rhine River, and they were taking a lot of flak, and my dad's radio quit. And so when he returned to his base in England, he asked his crew chief to just to check it out. He figured there were holes in the canopy, and he thought that a piece of shrapnel had come through the plexiglass and had cut a wire in the radio. So they checked out the radio. There was a huge radio behind the pilot's seat in the cockpit. They didn't have transistors, and so the radios were big and heavy and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't find anything wrong with the radio, and they couldn't find anything wrong on the instrument panel. So finally they found that the pilots didn't wear crash helmets. They just wore a leather helmet. I don't know what you call it, just a leather helmet. And it had big Bakelite plastic earphones sticking out of both sides for them to use the radio. And this piece of shrapnel had come through the canopy and had come through the leather and had come through the plastic and had cut the wires in my dad's earphone just a few fractions of an inch from his head. So the Lord was watching out for him that day, and he always saved that piece of shrapnel. He was going to have it made into a charm bracelet for my mom, a charm for her charm bracelet, and he never actually got around to it. So when Dad died, I was going through his stuff at the house, and I saw this little box, and I knew what it was because I'd seen it as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I said, I found it. So I've still got that little piece of shrapnel. It's in a little tiny jewelry box padded with cotton.
We've got a picture of that as well at KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And I've got to ask you, because you can tell us, we can't figure it out for ourselves. We can't walk in your shoes. But when you hold that little tiny piece of shrapnel in your hand, what does it signify to you? It seems like it means a whole lot more than a little piece of iron.
Yeah, it's pretty special. I served her in Vietnam, but I never saw any action. And I know I have a lot of friends that did see action in Vietnam, and I've had a lot of friends that were veterans of different wars. But to actually see that come out of my dad's helmet, where it could have very easily caused him to die, it really brings to life the seriousness of war, and the fact that some things are worth fighting for. My dad always said, you know, wars are not fought for freedom, they're fought for liberty. Mm-hmm. And we used to talk about war, and he said war is no good. He hated war, but he said some things are worth fighting for. Mm. And that's kind of a symbol to me.
Amen. Anything else that you want to share with our listeners? And would you like to share with us what Memorial Day means to you?
Yeah, I always, it's funny, I don't think of my own service at all. I was only in for 5 years during Vietnam, and I was spent the whole time in Europe. But even as a kid, on Memorial Day, I always used to call my dad when I was in college, and then after I got out of the service, I always called my dad on Memorial Day and said, thanks for serving.
Mm-hmm.
And he was proud of it. He was always proud of it, and till his dying day.
As well he should be. I guess we have a lot to be thankful for, huh?
We sure do.
That is Marshall McCall with a story I hope is encouraging to you baby boomers who maybe don't have that World War II veteran parent around anymore. You never know, you might still get a little insight. We're going to meet a veteran of a different generation from the U.S. Marine Corps. She, yes, I said she, is just back from the war in Afghanistan. She is 29 years old, a recipient of the Purple Heart, someone who has experienced firsthand, quite recently, what it means on this Memorial Day when we reflect on the price of freedom.
It's Sergeant Marianne Miller, a Clovis native, graduate of Buchanan High School. I'm imagining that a war zone is a lot different than playing water polo for the Bears or running around on the basketball court over there. What made you decide you wanted to be in the Marine Corps? Did that come from?
It all started after high school. My dad told me, you know, it's time to go to college, pick a school. And growing up, he always told me, you know, he was in the Air Force and he really enjoyed his time there. So after I got my 2-year degree at Cuesta Community College, I figured, came back home and I figured, hey, why not join the military? I wasn't doing anything. Didn't want to really do too much more school. It was kind of just too much for me at the time. So I thought, you know, the Air Force maybe, you know. So I looked into the military and I went by. And, of course, the first stop was the Marine Corps recruiting station. Talked to them and I said, Dad, I want to join. And he told me, well, how about looking at the other branches? You know, Navy, Air Force, you know, how about we look around? And a couple days later, I told him, you know, Dad, I'm set, you know, the Marine Corps. And he said, you know, why don't you call your uncle? My uncle Paul from North Carolina is a 20-year retired mass sergeant in the Marine Corps. So I talked to him, and he finally put the stamp on the paper and said, you know, you're an athletic girl. You want the most for your money. You're going to have the best challenge. So go Marine Corps. And that's what I chose.
Have you regretted that decision at all?
Not at all.
I didn't get the idea that you did. So this was something that you were very sure about. And obviously none of the training or anything you went through discouraged you from that. How did you end up being deployed to Afghanistan, and what were your duties there?
I actually volunteered for this deployment. It's called the Female Engagement Team, which a lot of people might be familiar from Iraq with the Lioness Program. It was when a lot of females, local females, were smuggling in drugs or any kind of ammunition or weapons. So they would pull women from all different jobs from wherever they could and have them kind of go to the entry control points of bases or be on vehicles and go on patrols with the men and find these women and search them. And they were finding a lot of stuff on them. So we finally caught on to that. So when we went to Afghanistan, they got something new that's called the Female Engagement Team. We're the fourth iteration. So it was actually, this FET team's a lot different than the most before us. It was actually half reservists, half active duty. So when the word came out There was actually two of us girls who volunteered for this deployment, me and Corporal Arias, who is a Sacramento native.
Mm-hmm.
And we volunteered, and the way it goes, it's with the FET team, it goes, we deploy for every 7 months, so we rotate from the East Coast out of North Carolina and then the West Coast out of Camp Pendleton. So basically, we just swip swap. So since we volunteered, we actually got sent to the East Coast out of North Carolina and started our work up from there for 6 months and then deployed for 7.
Going into it, did you have any real idea of what kind of danger you'd be putting yourself in?
I mean, you can Google it. You can hear stories from others. The ones that care most about you've been through it before, you know, kind of sugarcoat it and tell you're going to be all right and listen to the training. But we had no clue what we were going to get into besides seeing, you know, researching it on the internet. But there wasn't too much since it was pretty much new. But a lot of girls that actually I went to boot camp with a girl, Sergeant Martz, is actually from San Clemente, California. She actually told me she did the Lioness program and she enjoyed it a lot. So
once you got over there, what were the kinds of things that you actually did with the Afghan people? What your day-to-day duties? We'll get to the incident that is the one that really stands out for you. But as far as the day-to-day duties that you would carry out, what was that like?
We go on patrol with the grunts, the infantrymen, and we'd go on patrols anywhere from 3 hours to 6 hours, just depending on, you know, what the day, what the patrol was that, you know, the officer or person in charge had planned for us for that day. Sometimes we'd pick houses or compounds out that we already knew of people that we wanted to stop by that asked us for stuff. For instance, you know, if they needed breast milk or, you know, my kids need a couple toys or we need help, you know, with food. So we'd bring some beans and rice towards for them. But most of the patrols consisted of, you know, just making, you know, that liaison in the community, that friendship with the women. You know, helping them out, telling them they do have a voice, you know, help them with women's governance. We had a corpsman actually with me for a couple months, which we used her a lot to help out with the local clinic, which we were actually glad to have in our area. Not too many girls had it. So we go down there and help them with any kind of medication or any kind of questions or anything that they had there. So education, things like that.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you right there. Now we know what Marianne Miller was doing in Afghanistan. When we come back, we'll find out how she came to receive the Purple Heart. Thanks for spending your Memorial Day with us as we honor all who serve on KMJ. Welcome back to this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes, visiting now with a veteran of a much younger vintage than what you're used to hearing on Saturdays. 29-year-old Marine Sergeant Marianne Miller of Clovis has told us why she volunteered to serve, but is there anything that can possibly prepare you for a suicide bomber?
Was I prepared? No. Were we prepared? No, I don't think so for something so big like that. You know, and the corpsman, the HM1 that was working with me at the time, she told me, you know, when I heard the blast go off, I came outside the tent to see what was going on, and someone just yelled at her, get your gear, put your gear on. So she had walked over to the BAS, which is basically a tent where you can seek medical treatment. She asked, you know, one of the corpsmen there, hey, what's going on? And they said, you know, it's a mass casualty. And from, you know, her being prior in Iraq, you know, having that prior deployment, she said a mass casualty to her would be, you know, 5 people. So she thought, you know, no big deal, 5 people. Let me get my gear on and wait for those people to come up so I could treat them medically. Were we prepared? Like I said, no. The training that we got was, I mean, the best training we could have gotten. Were we prepared for that many casualties? No. Were we prepared for that incident? Not really. You know, it's so close to home, so close to base. But we were prepared training-wise, yes.
Where was this and what happened? Walk us through what you remember about that day.
This was in Kajaki Sulfa, Helmand Province. And basically, we were coming back from a patrol this day, coming back to our patrol base, our PB, which actually sits above the hill of the local bazaar that sits right below. The local bazaar, like I tell a lot of people, it's like a swap meet. You know, a lot of stuff's going on. A lot of people are down there drinking chai, hanging out with their friends. It's loud, you know. I mean, and the main highway goes right through it, the main highway 611. So it's not a paved road or anything. It's dirt. You know, the cars, a lot of taxis, a lot of motorcycles. So it's pretty noisy. We had saw an informant that we had known before, so the team leader had actually halted our patrol, and he actually was talking to this informant that he had seen and he had made good liaison with. So he was trying to get some information out of him while the rest of us halted. I was actually sent security right outside a local shop when there was a linguist go ahead and stopped, and since they were serving pork that day, which they don't eat pork because of their culture, he wanted to buy, you know, some chicken since the patrol was halted right before we went up. So we went ahead and, you know, got some chicken. I set security. He bought me a little Danish. And, you know, I was eating it and I was setting security and everything was good. I mean, everybody was friendly. We saw the same faces, nothing out of the ordinary. Then I sat security, ate my Danish, and looked across the way and I'd see my battle buddy, you know, Sergeant Welch from Long Beach. She was standing across the street, huddled around a bunch of kids, kind of kneeling around her. And I thought, you know, why am I over here setting security? Let me get someone else to set security and let me go over there and engage with her, you know, with the local children and stuff, which were always happy to see us and always gathered around us in big crowds. So I saw her and my linguist, and I got someone to set security. There was two other guys that were actually buying monsters and stuff from the bazaar as well with the linguist con, getting some chicken for dinner that night. So I headed across the street and engaged with about a seven-year-old with a six-month-old girl in her hands. And, you know, just making googly eyes at her, lifting my glasses up, just kind of making the baby girl laugh so they would feel like, you know, I was nice and then, you know, let me in so we can kind of have some start some kind of friendship.
And it sounds like that's what you were really getting out of this, that that's maybe where your fulfillment came from, this opportunity to just be there with these people, kind of like being a goodwill ambassador almost, right?
Correct. Just being their friends. That's all we try to do was, yeah. You know, show our faces around town and let them know, hey, we're just here to be friends. We're just here to talk. We're just here to hang out. We're not here to get information from you, kick down your door, and start arresting your women and men. That's not what we are there to do. We were there to, you know, make friends, make the women stronger in their community, let them know their rights so they could stick up for themselves and not have to sit at the home all day locked in their compound.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, we were making a good mark in the town there. So I had walked across the street to engage with this girl and my battle buddy and our linguist. And before I knew it, it must have been 5 seconds after I crossed that street, a big blast went off. It kind of took me back. I really didn't know if it was for real for a second. I mean, I knew it was for real, but just I think I was in shock that, you know, this could happen so close to the base. We were done with the patrol. It was, you know, in the bazaar where all our, you know, close-knit friends were, or at least we thought were. It was a suicide bomber leaned up against a motorcycle in the bazaar, you know, the same spot he was standing, maybe a foot away from where I was standing before I had crossed the street of the bazaar.
Mm.
The shrapnel had flown out and sliced off a lot of people's legs, caused a lot of injuries to a lot of the locals, a lot of damage. A lot of people, you know, don't know. You know, people. A lot of people say they get hit by shrapnel, but they don't understand the extent to shrapnel. But the shrapnel, you know, sliced off people's legs, arms, you know, heads, a bunch of injuries that day. Mostly to little kids. Not too many adults were down there that day.
Mm.
So, you know, with that being said, the blast went off. It was just like, you know, in the movies, how you see it, your ears start ringing. Bunch of dirt and dust. You couldn't see. I mean, I couldn't see my battle buddy, you know, right in front of me, 2 feet. So my first thing thinking she was dead. You know, I couldn't see her. I was screaming for her. My ears were ringing. I couldn't hear anything. The girl that I was engaging with actually was handing me her little sister, the six-month-old. And you could see her blanket that she was wrapped in because they wrapped the babies in really tight. You could just see it turn red.
Mm.
You could tell that something had happened. That baby later on we found out had taken shrapnel to the stomach. There was nothing we could do for her, but she just does. Every once in a while comes up to the base and gets checked out by the doc, and she's doing fine.
Wow.
She survived. So after the blast went off, you know, it was just my job to just check on the squad. I think everybody had got hit really bad with shrapnel in my squad except for my battle buddy and I, Sergeant Welch. Sergeant Welch, I guess, had shot the opposite way into the bazaar, so I didn't see her, dragging our linguist who had a fractured to his leg, which ended up getting medevaced and having 4 rods in his leg. He survived that day. She put him in one of the local Afghan National Police trucks, and he got drove up to the base to get medevaced. You know, like I said, you know, first reaction was to, you know, to help my fellow Marines. So I ran down and, you know, started helping him with any kind of treatment. You know, what does this guy need? Holding IV bags, doing anything I could for these Marines, you know, just making sure that they were okay. Cook-off rounds were flying. The weapons were hot. People were getting shot. We didn't know, you know, if someone was shooting at us or if there was going to be a secondary. You know, that was kind of one of my my worries.
Sure.
So I started posting security. I started telling these grunts that I was on a patrol with, hey, you set security over there. You know, more and more people after the suicide bomber had detonated, more people were coming down from base, so I had more bodies to send out to post security. After I got security posted, I started telling the Marines, hey, start picking up the weapons, you know, put them in the back of the trucks. Let's get these things secured. You know, let's start getting these bodies up the hill. Let's start getting treatment. You know, it seemed like everybody was moving slow. You know, my adrenaline was pumping. I feel like I wanted stuff done right there, right then. And a lot of people weren't reacting like I was. So it was kind of hard to kind of direct these Marines, you know, with chaos, you know, and a lot of people weren't all coherent. We did lose one Marine that day, Corporal McGee. He died. He was a double amputee. He lost both legs that day. And then about, I said, when we got home from deployment mid-April, another guy that I had actually had three things that was wrong with him, a ruptured eye. I think it was an infection. And I believe he had an injury to his leg as well. I don't really know the extent of all his injuries. But he did actually pass away from a kidney infection. So he passed away as soon as we got back from deployment. Like I said, you know, just setting security, making sure the weapons, you know, were in our possession, all the gear, anything that we left down there, trying to clean up the situation as well as get all these Marines and all these locals, you know, in some kind of orderly fashion, which we never expected, 71 casualties that day. You know, me and my battle buddy, Sergeant Welch, saw a Marine land on the side of the road, and I saw that everything was secure. We had security. Weapons were picked up. I said, you know, let's pick up this Marine, and both her and I carried him, you know, up this mountainside up to our patrol base. And from there, you know, she said, you know, I think you're hit. You got blood on you. And I said, don't worry about it. It's fine. You know, our next step is to go down and get more bodies. So
had you even realized that you'd been hit?
I knew something was wrong. Midway through me trying to help a lot of people out, I could feel my arm get really weak. There was something just about my right arm. A piece of shrapnel actually hit the nerve, and it was the deepest piece that I had got. So I could barely hold my weapon. So I had her take my weapon as I, you know, help the other people that I was helping out with medical treatment.
Well, we need to catch a quick break, but when we come back, we'll come down the home stretch with Sergeant Marianne Miller. She's describing these events, but not drawing much attention to the fact that she was wounded in that suicide attack. The rest of her story when this Hometown Heroes Memorial Day special continues after this on KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Thank you so much for spending these 2 hours with us as we mark this Memorial Day and reflect on those who have given their lives in the service of our country. Marianne Miller has related the circumstances of the suicide attack she survived in Afghanistan at the start of this year, but the Marine sergeant was focused on trying to help others, it seems. When was it that you finally realized the extent of your own injuries?
I don't think I ever really realized them. Finally, after the second time I came up to the patrol base and it seemed like all the people were up there and the docs were taking care of people there on base, I had volunteered to stay with the linguists, and I told Sergeant Welch, you know, you go ahead and go help the patients over there, because we had tons of patients, and any kind of help we could on these patients waiting for a corpsman and just, you know, putting them in, you know, from least to greatest, or, you know, and then the people that needed medical treatment the most, you know, those are the people that the docs were going to, and they were just making their rounds. So I stayed with my linguist in the medical tent, and he was bleeding out pretty bad, you know, and saying some crazy things. We had to give him a shot of Motrin, you know, and he gets sick to the side of blood. So I'm in there, and, you know, finally that's when a Marine had came by and said, hey, you need to get checked too. And, you know, I told him I'm fine. But he did notice that, you know, I did have a couple pieces of shrapnel, and, you know, he brought it to my attention. Hey, you sit down, calm down, relax. Let the other Marines on base take care of it. You've done enough. You've done your part.
Now, there's something you said that I think if our listeners were paying close attention, they probably caught. But you told the story about you were handling what you were handling, and you saw your battle buddy across the way and walked over to join her. And then you told us that the suicide bomber had been very close to where you were originally. How many times have you wondered, if you hadn't crossed that street, if you hadn't gone to where she was, do you think you'd even be here talking to me right now?
You know, that's a good question. I can't say yes or no. You know, we had a linguist who got flown across, or got knocked out and flew across the bazaar with a, you know, traumatic brain injury, and he was in a coma for 5 days. He was standing maybe a foot from me. You know, Corporal McGeith, we lost that day. He was standing, a foot to the left of me, who lost both his legs. And, you know, there was another Marine that was, he wasn't injured as severely, but, you know, he did have a lot of shrapnel to his body. But it's just, you know, it's just one of those things. You just never know. You could be standing right next to someone, you know, and lose that person, or lose that Marine, you know, and you're standing right by him. So you just never know. You know, I just thank God. I mean, it was a miracle. Obviously, someone was looking over me that day, and I'm grateful.
You may have survived, but there's no doubt you would have been wounded a lot worse than you were, most likely, if you had stayed where you were, right? I mean, am I understanding that correctly?
Correct. You're definitely right.
So do you think, and now you just said you thank God, do you think there was some divine intervention in prompting you to move over there, or making that catch your eye? What do you believe about that?
Yes, I do. I really think so. I mean, as I look back on the situation, you know, and we're trying to piece together the situation the next couple days after the incident, I thought I had noticed actually to my right about 2 feet away, a kind of middle-aged man in a nice blue uniform with a kid sitting on his lap in a nice white uniform. They're both, you know, nice, clean. The man was well-shaved. And, you know, usually people say, you know, when the suicide bomber is around, these locals actually will clean up, you know, nice shave, nice clothes, kind of, you know, like as you would, you know, a lot of people can understand here when you bury, you know, a loved one, you're going to, you know, make sure they look nice and presentable and you're going to, you know, a beautiful dress on them or a nice tuxedo. It's same thing with the locals there, you know, and I thought I had spotted them. But I think that's what made me go across the street is that I spotted something out of the norm. And then something was telling me, hey, go across and engage with my battle buddy and the linguist. So whatever it was, definitely saved my life that day.
Amen. As we mark this Memorial Day, and this is still so fresh in your mind, and what was the date that this unfolded?
January 18th.
January 18th. So we're talking a little more than 4 months since this all happened. This will be the first Memorial Day for you since then. What's going to be on your mind?
Just everyone we've lost, you know, everybody that is still overseas, obviously. You know, there's a lot of people, like I told you before, I've been to Buchanan High School. I graduated high school from there. You know, there's a lot of people who've passed from there. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of family members serve, you know, and this means a great deal to them that this is their day. You know, and definitely this is a day where I'll sit down and you know, I'll think about, you know, all the times that I've had and the close calls, you know, like you said, and the people we've lost and just what it means to me now. And it means a lot more than from when I first joined and from before deploying. Now I can see that it means a lot more to me.
And you are volunteering for another deployment.
Yes, come January here, I was thinking about going on maybe like a ship or a Mew and get a short deployment, maybe 4 months, you know, somewhere nice, Germany, Australia. I'll see what's available for me to volunteer for, and I definitely would love to get another deployment, yes.
And I guess I have to ask you this, too, and I go back to this. Most of the people that I interview are World War II veterans, and many of them didn't have a choice. There was a draft then, and almost everyone who was able-bodied, at least of the male gender, was in. There were over 350,000 women serving then, too. But you don't have to do this. You're doing this because you choose to. So what drives that choice? Why do you want to continue doing what you're doing in the Marine Corps, even after it almost took your life there in Afghanistan?
You know, I used to always say that joining the Marine Corps, I felt like I wasn't a Marine. I felt like I hadn't given enough, you know, until I felt like I needed to deploy to, you know, to understand that. And, you know, I guess in a sense it was a good thing, but in a sense, you know, even if you are a Marine, you know, you've made that commitment, you've given your life, you know, you've given the service 4 years, you know, I mean, that would have been good for me, but now I'm on the other side of the tracks now and I have deployed. And, you know, just the camaraderie, the friendship that you make, I mean, just in general in the Marine Corps, I mean, I've met a lot of people, and I still keep in contact with these people. But just the camaraderie that you have, you know, when there's no worries, it's just a simple life overseas. You know, you're not worried about paying the bills or, you know, people aren't worried about their kids. It's just you and them out there, you know, whether it's a female standing next to you with a weapon or, you know, whoever it is, you know, basically you have their back, they have yours, and that's what it comes down to is that, you know, we're brothers and sisters, you know, and we all understand that, so... Just the camaraderie, I think, is what I love about the Marine Corps, just the sense of closeness and friendship, and not a lot of other branches have that.
If I read between the lines there, it kind of sounds like you're saying, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Correct, pretty much. Hoorah.
Well, I want to thank you for serving our country, and if there's anything else that you want to share with our listeners so that we understand what the men and women overseas right now are going through, is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
Just pretty much, if you don't know a service member from whatever branch, it could be Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, Navy. I mean, just even if you could be a pen pal to one of them riding overseas, or if someone has an American flag or a Marine Corps flag outside of their house that lives next to you, just knock on their door and chat with them. The troops are over there fighting for your freedom. You know, the least, a lot of people say, what can we do to give back? You know, can we send care packages? No, just be a friend to one. You know, make sure you know at least one. Be a friend, talk to them, and let them know how you feel, and they'll definitely spread that along and forward.
Well, let me throw this one at you, too. I think that when you go around in your uniform and maybe even wearing that Purple Heart that you received, some people will refer to you as a hero. How do you feel about that, and how do you define what a hero is?
You know, a lot of my friends, a lot of people that I've worked with actually said, you know, gosh, Harmel, you're a hero now, you know. And I just kind of chuckle and tell him, you know, I'm just the same ordinary girl, you know, just Marianne, you know, same girl back on the block that you knew 10 years ago. You know, I don't see myself as a hero. I just see myself as, you know, any other Marine just doing our job. I see heroes as, you know, Vietnam vets or people that paid the ultimate sacrifice, you know, people that paved the way for us years before. And history only repeats itself. So, you know, those are my heroes.
We are surrounded by heroes. Sometimes we just forget that. On this Memorial Day, make sure you thank the veterans in your life for their service and don't take anything for granted. Thanks for spending these 2 hours with us. I hope you'll think about joining us each Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.